Greetings, Couch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr.
And I'm Mel Valentine.
And you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Thank you, Mel, for being here. We got a new guest host. Mel has been on the show before. He was on a couple times. He was on for a special segment we did, oh gosh, it was like a year and a half, 2 years ago, about Michael Bay.
The infamous, yes.
Yeah, you and Robert Fury had a little bit of Michael Bay versus Roland Emmerich discussion. And you also were on the Best of the Year. Were you on this year? I didn't have you on for Best of the Year this past year, did I?
Yeah, I don't know what happened. You skipped me. You forgot all about me.
I know. I was fickle. That happens. But anyways, Mel, tell us who you are, where you can get a hold of you, and you know what you're all about.
Well, I'm a movie critic. I write about film. I write for eFilm Critic and Movie Vault, or actually I used to write for Movie Vault, and SF Station, a local San Francisco site. I've been there for going on 6 years in June. And I'm also a former Cinematical writer.
One of the many,
sadly.
What's funny is, and I've said this, I'm a former AOL, I am an AOL... A layoffy, I guess you could say. Only this happened to me from a corporate layoff when I worked at CompuServe about 15 years ago, and they actually paid me a severance package. So,
yeah, my severance package was zero. It was one last check and an email saying, thank you for your services.
Wow. Thank you for your services. Feel free to write for free.
Yes, that part, which unfortunately got someone fired for telling the truth, unfortunately, for her.
Anyways, thank you for being on the show. This is, like I said, first time you've been on Fat Guys proper. So welcome. And
you
can get us, Fat Guys of the Movies. You can get us at fatguysofthemovies.com. You can go to iTunes and search Fat Guys of the Movies, and we pop right up. Also, Fozzie Bear's podcast shows up. He's poaching our iTunes searches, apparently. There's also our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/FGATM. Go ahead and like us. Tell us how awesome we are. Share it with your friends. And you can email us at fatguys@filmschoolrejects.com or leave us a voicemail at 740-205-6456. We got one this week from the infamous Gabe from Arizona. So you want to listen to that in a later segment. But before we do that, let's talk about some films.
Wonderful.
First up, we've got Priest, in which Paul Bettany kicks ass for the Lord.
There was a fan attack. Your brother, he's hurt bad.
Where's Lucy?
They took her.
There is no vampire menace.
Fine, Lucy. Bring her home. And you promise me something, brother. Kill them all.
If you take any action to leave the cities, you will be stripped from the order.
I have no choice.
One of your own has broken his sacred vow. You will find him
dead or alive.
You're going to check this out. They didn't screen this. It's Screen Gems, and Screen Gems is a misnomer because there's very little gem
in the screens.
Not gems.
Definitely not. And yeah, they do sci-fi horror.
It's like
horror,
that
mostly.
Hole in the wall Chinese restaurant that says gourmet Chinese food, and you're like, yeah, that's not gourmet.
You see the cats go in, but not go out. No, sorry. Yeah. But yeah, yeah. Once you see the name Screen Gems, you know pretty much if it's sci-fi horror, they're not going to screen it for press. And if there's an advanced screening, we're not invited. We're disinvited. So those of us who want to review it or have to review it have to go opening day like everybody else.
That's right. And pay good hard money. And yes, for the expensive ones, too, because it's 3D and an IMAX.
Yes, which is why I'll be seeing it at a bargain matinee at 8:30 in the morning.
With like 12-year-old kids.
Pretty much. Well, I mean, seeing it later on, you know you're going to get your horde of teenagers and cell phone users. And, you know, for that type of film, I think earlier is actually better.
You know what's funny? I've noticed, I don't know if you've noticed this. One of the things I think is the advantage of 3D movies is I think the fact you have to wear the glasses and you can't like move your head too much or it'll go out of focus, that actually I've noticed reduces the amount of people talking and texting and doing stupid things during movies because they kind of have to keep their head in at least a reasonable position. Have you noticed that?
I've only been to a couple that I've had to pay with the regular audience that have 3D, and you're right about that. I didn't notice too much going on with the crowd. Yeah. But those
I even notice people don't even talk to each other, because a lot of times they'll lean over, and when you lean over, you kind of have to tilt your head a little bit. So
yeah, or they'll slip and slide because they're oversized to fit many different size heads. Yes. So
they all fit my head because I have to squeeze it on because I got a giant roast for a head.
Well, I have to wear them over my glasses, my regular glasses, yeah. Which kind of sucks, but yeah, you live with it. So. But at least I actually get the 3D effect. I know actually quite a few people don't get that at all.
Yeah.
Was it Johnny Depp can't see in 3D, or he can't see using 3D technology?
I think Johnny Depp just takes a lot of drugs and that's just a result. He's lost his depth perception from all the drugs he takes. Not to insinuate or imply or directly say that Johnny Depp takes drugs, but
if you've seen The Tourist, you're kind of you probably kind of think that anyway. I don't know. Did you see The Tourist? Yeah. Did you?
I hated The Tourist. Oh, likewise. One of the worst of the year.
It was atrocious. Well, anytime the one of the co-stars basically says the reason she did the movie was because she'd go on vacation with her family, you know, in Italy. I was like, well, really? That was your main reason? Okay.
Yeah. Well, it was The Tourist. It was a crappy movie. It was terrible. And an awful, and the guy who directed it had such a great movie before it, so.
Right, The Lives of Others, right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So depressing.
Well, they had no chemistry, which is really surprising.
Yeah.
And he just seemed really exhausted.
From all that drugs.
Right.
And he must have gone and seen a lot of 3D movies.
Yes.
During that time. What are your thoughts on Priest, even though we haven't seen it?
Well, I actually saw some footage of it back at WonderCon at the beginning of April, which had, I won't say it gave me high hopes, but it gave me some hope that it would at least be some amount of fun. You know, you don't expect much from, you know, science fiction, vampires, action film, Priest that can do, you know, all sorts of things. I mean, it's based on a Korean comic book. With
the most ludicrous premise that they're just like, in the future, priests are these like ninja warriors that kill vampires.
Well, you get a real flavor if you see the trailers and the commercials and the extended footage that they're riffing a lot on Judge Dredd and that character, because everyone's retreated into these giant walled cities and you know, you have these wastelands and you go outside the cities.
I'm pretty sure never once does Paul Bettany say, "I'm the law."
But he's judge, jury, and executioner, especially when it comes to the vampires. So.
Well, do vampires have rights? I mean, really? I don't think they do.
No, they don't. So, and one of the pluses, I guess, is, and I didn't realize this even though seeing her name, the young female lead, Lily Collins, who's in one of the half dozen comic book films. One half dozen Snow White films coming out soon.
Oh, okay.
She's the daughter of Phil Collins. Did you know
that? Well, that's awesome.
Isn't it?
This is like Willow Smith in a different version of it.
Well, she may, who knows, she may have some talent. She's certainly pretty enough. So,
they didn't screen it for us. So we have to give it a preemptive suck. We're going to leave though this segment with playing the trailer for Everything Must Go, which Will Ferrell plays a guy in a country western song who loses his wife, his job, and his home.
Hi, are you in there? If you are, can this happen another day?
So are you getting rid of your old stuff?
I got fired from my job, and my wife left me.
If I'm honest, I saw this coming a mile away.
Thanks for warning me.
I've gotten some complaints about someone living on their lawn.
This is my corner. I'm not leaving my stuff.
City of Arcadia allows a property owner to hold a yard sale for no more than 5 consecutive days. This buys you 3 days.
Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. We went out talking a little bit about Priest. We're both going to see it. We're both not expecting much. It gets preemptive suck because it's Screen Gems. And they didn't screen it for us.
Not even give us a chance. You know?
No.
Not even
they don't. The last genre movie that they screened was Quarantine.
Oh, right.
I guess you can call... Maybe Takers was a bit of a... They did screen Takers. I don't know if I call that a genre movie as much... It's not sci-fi horror.
Right. I think it's when they get into sci-fi horror, they're expecting to get blasted by critics.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate, because some of us do, you know, there are critics out there who love the genre and are just looking for good films
in
the genre. And sometimes there are there.
All those Screen Gems and their horror, it still doesn't have a good track record.
No.
So I don't think that they're... I think the last sort of really crappy genre horror that they did was... that they actually screened for us was The Covenant.
Saw that, yes. Yeah. Oh, that's a long time ago, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. They learned their lesson.
Yeah.
We just heard the trailer for Everything Must Go. Did you get a chance to check that one out?
I did indeed, yes.
What'd you think?
I didn't love it, but I did like it. And a lot of that just had to do with Will Ferrell, you know, taking another dramatic turn. It's a comedy drama, so it's sort of within his wheelhouse and his comfort zone. He gets to do a lot of the sort of Will Ferrell shtick. You know, he's kind of playing an obnoxious boar in a lot of ways. But he goes through the you know, character arc transformation from boar to more self-enlightened or self-aware character who realizes the consequences of his actions on other people. But so it's mostly for him. My main problem with it is that it just goes into a very sort of simplistic territory and the way it winds things up. Okay. Doesn't bear any relation to reality, but that's sort of the nature.
It does. I will say this: it's because he's an alcoholic,
yes,
and he's got a drinking problem, and he's living on his front lawn because his ex-wife or soon-to-be ex-wife has kicked all his stuff, literally kicked him to the curb. But yeah, he does sort of solve a drinking problem in the last 15 minutes, which if you know any alcoholics or if you have an alcoholic in your life, or if you ever had to deal with it, it's not that easy. You don't just be like, you know what, I'm just going to stop drinking. It's a struggle. And it's not something that you can just wake up one day and just throw the beer cans into the garbage.
Right. And he's supposed to sort of bottom out because he loses the job, the wife, the home, he's sleeping on a lawn, you know, and he gets to sort of bizarre 3-day extension so he could actually still sleep on the lawn and not go to jail. You know, there's some coincidences you have to always buy at the beginning of films like that.
Yeah.
But my main problem was that then it just reduces it near the end of the film to, why is he an alcoholic? Oh, well, we just go back to the family background.
Yeah.
And I almost wish that it hadn't said anything about him and just sort of left that up in the air. I mean, it's an indie drama. You could take that risk. And they chose to go very simplistic and that kind of, you know, take on character psychology as if he didn't have a choice. You know, that's the explanation, and I think it ends up being a plea for sympathy for the character that he doesn't need, that it should just be based on, you know, his transformation or change within the story rather than some fact about his father, you know, and some home videos.
I personally just didn't like it. I don't, it was too much of a mopey movie. I'm not into mopey movies. And so if there's somebody who's, even if there's an uplifting ending, if you're spending time just wallowing in your own pity and feeling sorry for yourself, I lose interest so fast. And as much as I love Will Ferrell, and I loved Stranger Than Fiction, I thought he did a fantastic job with that movie.
I agree. Yeah.
This one was just so, I'm just like, I didn't care about him. I didn't like him. He wasn't a likable character. And yet it was a little bit of redeemability, sure, maybe, but it was, I think it cobbles itself by being too mean-spirited in its own right. And then I also don't like Rebecca Hall, so.
Oh, what?
She is so annoying. And she's attractive.
She's another positive.
She's like, what?
What? She's another positive. And no, I didn't mention her earlier.
No, she's like Liv Tyler. She looks like she's been punched in the face.
She's a much thinner Liv Tyler. Well,
she's pregnant in this movie.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't look particularly real. I think she's actually terrific. I think she's beautiful, and I really liked her in The Town. I know she's a British actress, so I give her points, too, for doing an American accent flawlessly, unlike American actors who can't do British accents to save their lives.
What's all this, then?
So, and hey, it had Biggie Small's son. Come on.
Well, I guess that I turned around.
That's another positive. Come on.
I'm going to have to say, we're going to have to give final grades on this one. I have to say it kind of sucked.
I gave it like a 2.5 out of 5. So
where did
it was really just
sucked, rocked, kind of sucks, kind of rocks.
It's right smack in the middle.
Right, you know, in the middle, kind of rocked, kind of sucks, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
You didn't seem to love it as much as you originally.
Well, it's again, his likability carried it through. And I think There were particular moments in the film that were strong, but they just didn't tie together strong.
Okay. All right, let's move on to the next movie, which is Hesher, which I haven't seen. But Mel has. We'll deal with this real quick before moving on to Bridesmaids. But Hesher, a metalhead outcast, breaks apart a family to bring them closer together.
Life is like walking in the rain. You can hide and take cover, or you can just get wet.
How do you know this guy?
It's kind of a long story.
Hey!
I got a doctor's appointment.
Did I miss something?
Not really.
Mel, what'd you think?
It's another flawed film, but there it's another great Joseph Gordon-Levitt performance.
Are you a big Joseph Gordon-Levitt fan? Because he kind of blows hot and cold for me.
I am, actually. I mean, I think when he does the big budget mainstream films like Inception, he's kind of bland. I mean, it's great that he can do the action scenes and it's a challenge on a physical level for him. But it's the indie dramas that he really transforms himself from role to role. And that's a bias of mine. The actors who can really change themselves and, you know, they really dig into a particular character and their inner lives and express that through the physical actions of the character. Yeah. And you really feel this is a different character that he's playing. And it's not showy. I mean, one of the criticisms of, like, for example, one of my other favorite actors, Ryan Gosling, is that he can be a little showy. Sorry. That he can be a little showy, and I can see that. But with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, I don't see, you know, that he never goes over the top. And I think his performances are always, like, tight and self-contained. Although here, he's playing just this angry, raging, you know, metalhead who has no background or history. And the word Hesher is another word for metalhead. So he doesn't have a first name or last name or background. And one of the big pluses for me for the film is sort of the anti-everything must go. It doesn't go into his background. It doesn't give you a simple, simplistic explanation for why he is who he is. It just throws you and the other characters into the story and throws him into their lives. And the way he just disrupts them, you know, they accept it for a variety of reasons. So I think the initial premise works. It's just near the end of the film where I think the director loses a little faith in himself and in the material. And it's sort of the same thing where he goes for sort of a safe ending. And I think if he, you know, so he didn't stick the landing. He came so close. And
I've seen that with a lot of independent film where, because independent film is so hard to do and it's so high pressure and it's so hard to get your vision off the ground that a lot of times directors end up choking in the sense that they don't know exactly how to, well, like you say, stick the ending. They either go too safe, or they get the wrong advice, or they have a vision, but sometimes the vision isn't complete.
Yes.
So.
Well, and in the case of the Joseph Gordon-Levitt character, he's such the you know, nihilistic, angry young man that then they give him a character transformation that doesn't feel grounded in the film itself.
Yeah.
You know, it feels like it's just an exterior decision that was made. And I think they really should have just left the character as he was, because he's a catalyst character. He doesn't have to change. He's the one who's there to allow other characters to change. Okay. And there was a great cast, too. I mean, Natalie Portman, again, in her, like, 10th film this year. And the young guy who basically plays his counterpart holds his own. I haven't seen him in anything else.
Natalie Portman blows hot and cold for me, too. I mean, I've seen her.
She does. I agree with you there.
And then some, she's awful.
But Rainn Wilson is the father, and, you know, the premise is that it's a grief drama. They're both trying to get over the loss of their mother in a car accident, and they're dealing with it in very different ways. Rainn Wilson basically drugging himself into a stupor, and the other character, his son, who's basically left on his own, you know, running around. He's angry. He's pissed. You know, he doesn't know how to deal with it in any real constructive way. And Hesher basically allows him to deal with it in a destructive way all the way through. So,
real quick, what's your grade? Kind of sucks. Kind of rocks. All right. Yeah. And we're going to leave you with the trailer for Bridesmaids, which Kristen Wiig leads a cast of ladies in a raunchy comedy for lady types. And here you go.
Are you coming over tonight? I have big news.
Ooh, I can't wait. I'm engaged.
What?
Will you be my maid of honor?
Of course.
You'll love the rest of the bridesmaids.
I'd be more than happy to handle the bachelorette and the shower.
I think I can handle it.
I feel like her life is going off and getting perfect, and mine's just like,
I wanted to go over some ideas for the bachelorette party.
I was thinking Las Vegas.
Strip club.
Disney World.
Fight club.
Go to a fight club?
No, we're not going to go to a fight club.
Okay.
We're going to be the fight club.
Tough luck. 44 skulls buried in the ground, crawling down through the muck.
Oh, yeah.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies. We are in our infamous middle segment
where I burp.
Infamous, okay.
It's infamous. It's so famous. It's infamous. Quick, what movie is that from?
Oh, my God, I don't know.
You don't know?
I'm so infamous.
With a plethora of movies out there.
I know. Hopefully nothing by Kevin Smith.
No, it's The Three Amigos. The plethora is also another joke from
yes.
that movie.
Oh, I have not seen that film in such a long time.
It's so long ago.
It's bad.
And what's great, it's a fun movie, but it's really not that good.
It's a great cast.
It's a great cast, and it's good. It's a good movie, but it didn't live up to the cast, I think. But that's a different story. Let's talk about another movie that arguably I might be saying the similar thing.
It doesn't live up to the cast.
What are your thoughts on Bridesmaids?
I came very, very close to loving Bridesmaids. I'd say near fabulous. My main issue actually with Bridesmaids has nothing to do with the film and everything to do with the marketing, where keep hearing Hangover 2 for chicks, and I think that's just really going to do a disservice to the movie, and it might bring in opening weekend crowds. Thinking that they're going to see that type of film, R-rated. There's going to be raunch. There's going to be gross-out gags. It's going to be vulgar and profane, all of that stuff.
What was it? It was all that.
It was all that. But the commercials and ads sort of, set it up that they're going to Vegas, the whole Vegas thing. And I don't want to give away too much, but the sense that I get is that...
Not 1 minute of this movie takes place in Vegas. I'll just...
Okay, you're giving it away. All right.
There's no Vegas in this movie.
But it does seem to build towards that.
Is that too
right?
much of a spoiler? Do you think that's a spoiler?
I think it. Well, it shouldn't be a spoiler, but it feels like a spoiler because of the way the ads have been constructed around it.
Because it's not a Vegas movie,
right? And people hear that Hangover connection, and they think
it's
place
in Milwaukee,
right? It's instead of men behaving badly, women behaving badly, doing awful things to themselves and other people, but in a fun, outrageous way.
What's funny about how you phrase that is when I saw it, there was a. I always stay through the credits because I hate crowds and I hate walking through the crowd. So I'll sit there and check email or whatever on the phone while the credit's rolling. Because if they're going to come up to me and like, you got to put that away, security of the print, I'd be like, the hell with you, man. It's the credits. So what? Somebody's going to pirate like who the best boy grip is or best boy electric, excuse me.
Unless there's like a button scene at the end there after the credits tying in Bridesmaids to the Avengers. You never know.
Yeah, I was waiting for that. I was waiting for the shield reference at the end. But so I'm sitting there, and there's a group of older folks. They're probably at least in their 50s and maybe 60s. We're sitting there, and one of the woman from the in the group, one of the women in the group stands. She's like, "Well, that was really good. It wasn't too. That wasn't dirty or vulgar." And one of the guys was like, "It totally was dirty and vulgar." And I'm here going, "Did we see the same movie? Because that was just as vulgar and dirty as other things." And you said something, sort of similar to that in the sense that maybe is it because women are doing that it's less vulgar? I mean. Did you feel it was less vulgar than like The Hangover?
I didn't feel it. Well, I think in a sense, well, if you're looking at sort of quantity, then yes, because it sort of builds toward that, and you have the private moments between all the female characters. But there's so much else going on because it's a relationship comedy, the friendship comedy. There's sort of the romantic comedy elements, who she's going to choose, and the parts that I liked were the way it reflects sort of our current economic environment and, that she's down and out and she's really sort of rapidly moving toward the bottom. And it's not by choice. It's just the way things have worked out for her personally and professionally. She doesn't have a drinking problem, which is great.
That's true.
But she has flaws.
You know, I will say this, with Everything Must Go, they kind of miss the whole hitting rock bottom. There's nobody turning tricks in this movie. You know, nobody is getting herpes sores on their face as a result of this film. Well, at least not from that.
You're talking Bridesmaids or Everything Must Go?
Both. Everything Must Go. He's like, oh, he hit rock bottom. He's just drunk in his front yard for crying out loud. He's not. He's not like taking loads in the mouth at the dress shop.
That would have been quite the movie.
I mean, it would have been realistic. You're just on beer, for crying out loud. People know if you're gonna get drunk, you need something a lot harder.
Yeah, that was the other thing. It's like, why is he just so obsessed with beer?
It's a lot of, you gotta take, and if you're as big as Will Ferrell is, I mean, I'm a big dude. Beer, it goes through me so fast, and my body processes that I can't get drunk on it.
Well, there's a good point that if he's a true alcoholic, he's probably going to be drinking harder stuff to get drunk faster.
Yeah, and then like the scene where he gives away mouthwash. No way would an alcoholic give away mouthwash.
Anything that has alcohol, he'll drink, yes.
Exactly. Anyways, back to Bridesmaids.
Yes. But what, you didn't like, what's her name, Kristen?
Here's the thing. I like Kristen Wiig, and you know how you said you came very close to loving it. I came very close to hating it.
Really?
And a lot of it is, I think I was thinking a lot about it after I saw it because I just wasn't into it. Now it wasn't awful like Something Borrowed, which was just
flatlined. Yeah,
bad, awful film.
John Krasinski and Jennifer Goodwin. See, there's good in everything.
But no, here's the thing. John Krasinski was playing just another Jim Halpert. We've seen that
before.
Yes,
yeah. No, he was wasted, and I wish he hadn't done that film.
And Jennifer Goodwin, as adorable as she is, I got so tired of her voice.
How dare you?
About halfway through, it just kind of hit a tipping point.
Pistols at Dawn.
Would you? Pistols at Dawn? We're going to have to bring in the long pistols, because we're going to be about 50,000 miles away from each other.
There are times when you say, yeah, she's just adorable. And I thought she pulled off the character well. The problem, but we're talking about the wrong movie.
But Bridesmaids. The thing with Kristen Wiig, I like Kristen Wiig, but her delivery and her shtick, I'm getting more and more, and maybe it's just me getting cynical and older, I'm getting tired of actors that just bring a shtick to a movie. We had mentioned in pre-show about Vince Vaughn. He just brings his shtick.
Yes.
And I'm like, it's no fun. And I mean, some people can get away with it. Like Jack Nicholson always has just played his shtick.
Yeah.
But it works because he's appropriately cast. Kristen Wiig has her shtick, which is the kind of the mumbling, hemming, hawing. Oh, is that so? Oh my gosh, you're taking off your pants.
Yeah.
Isn't that nice? Oh my gosh. You know, which... That works as a supporting character. I thought she was very funny in MacGruber last year. I thought she did a great job in that. I thought she was very funny in movies like Extract. I thought she was funny in a very, very small part in Knocked Up. But
she was in that Ricky Gervais film too. What the Ghost Town? No.
Was she in Ghost Town?
She had a very small where he played the dentist. Was that the one I'm thinking of?
Yeah, Ghost Town.
Yeah. She had a very small part in that, and she was very funny, but she did actually do exactly what you just described.
Yeah, and I love that. I love her as a supporting role. I can't take it for a whole movie.
And I'm the opposite, where I've liked her in a couple roles, but she's left me cold in others. And I didn't think she could pull this off, and maybe because my expectations were so low about her range.
Yeah.
Because she has to handle some fairly, I won't say deep, but, you know, outside her comfort zone, as far as she's not doing comedy, you know, she's not getting the audience to laugh at her.
She's totally doing comedy, like from beginning to end. It's nothing but comedy and cuteness.
Cute, but there are moments I thought where she had to pull a little deeper, and she delivered.
See,
but
I mean, I think she did deliver. But for me, it's a core thing of. I didn't like her character, and I didn't like her and her portrayal of it. And part of it is the character. How old is Kristen Wiig? She's what, 30, 35?
Mid-30s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. When Judd Apatow produced Superbad, because everyone's going, it's a Judd Apatow movie. It's not, he's producing it. So
yeah, and she co-wrote it too. So
yeah. But like in Superbad, when you got Michael Cera and Jonah Hill's character, and they're being just complete morons. It makes sense because they're 18 years old and they're stupid kids.
Yeah.
When you're 35 and you're acting like this, it's just, to me, it's just pathetic. And I found no sympathy there.
Wow, you're incredibly judgmental of other people's failings.
I am so critical.
Well, you can't see her with John Hamm? I mean, considering, you know, John Hamm, who he is, and she's going for the look, she's going for...
Well, but he was a dick.
Right, but... I certainly have known people who've done that or have done it myself. I don't want to admit to too much. You know, where you make a choice based on physical appearance as mm-hmm. opposed to the other qualities a person may have or a combination thereof. So mm-hmm. I found that not pathetic or, you know, especially considering...
It's a little pathetic when you're in your 30s. I mean, do you expect that from stupid people when they're 20? But when you're in your 30s and you start getting lumpy and your stuff starts sagging, you're like... You know, I mean, you can only be so judgmental. And so when people are in their 30s and they make these, they date somebody or they want to get married to somebody because of their looks, and they're a total asshole outside of that, I think it does reflect poorly on you when you're in your 30s.
I don't disagree there, but the way that the film was set up with her sort of being at a low point, that she had a previous relationship and, you know, her dream job.
Loads in the mouth.
Right. Well, she had a dream job, you know, being the bakery and owning her own business and all that disappeared. So I could see someone who's basically not hitting, you know, being close to rock bottom, settling for whatever happens to come by, you know.
And, I mean, I get it. Here's the thing. I look at the movie and I say, I can totally see other people loving this movie, and I can see this movie doing well, and I think it's going to do well this weekend. I had no patience for it. It just was rubbing me the wrong way. And then on top of it, like, and this is a small detail, but I'll give you an example. Her friend is played by Maya Rudolph, who's continually still miscast in films.
Well, her, I was going to say, she was the weak point for me.
Yeah. Well, and here's the thing that bothers me. There's a whole point in there where she talks about the character of Rose, that Rose Byrne plays Helen. She's talking about how she takes over the wedding and has all this expensive tastes, and her dad can't pay for it because her dad's got to pay for the wedding. And I'm like, then tell her no. If you're that weak of a character that you can't say no, we can't afford this ridiculous waste of money wedding. I mean, let's have something small and tasteful, but at least reasonable. That's a huge character flaw. And I've, again,
I've met people who have that character flaw, who have done exactly that, who have basically, I won't say mortgaged their futures, but they have they have paid for very expensive, or they haven't paid for, they, you know, big weddings paid on credit that they end up paying for 2 or 3 years later because they want the big massive wedding with 300 guests. So again, you know, I guess personal experience, I could see people doing that, or, you know, peer pressure, their friends, family, they've all had big weddings. There's that expectation, especially when it comes from parents.
But again, here's the thing. If that's a whiny little 22-year-old girl who's getting married, who's a princess, that I understand that.
But for 30-year-olds, no.
35, I'm sorry. That's just, it's...
You're zero sympathy for them. Okay.
Yeah, it's just because I'm like, well, at this point, you need to have your shit worked out.
Yeah. Yes.
but that's the stuff I didn't like. And then the other thing is, it felt to me like this was trying to prove girls poop too. We're going to have jokes with, you know, and this, and we're going to have puking and all that kind of stuff just to be raunchy for raunchy's sake. It also runs over 2 hours, and there's entire sequences of this film where I was just bored with the banter. And I get that some people are going to love that.
Yeah. Like
the whole thing with her and the cop. I was just so tired of that. I'm just like,
the
stuff with
the cop. I liked the stuff with the cop actually quite a bit.
Yeah.
I think it did get too long, and it seemed like there were several scenes that could have been trimmed or dropped completely, and the movie could have been stronger for it. So there was a little bit of self-indulgence there. I think it was her script, and, you know,
I thought Melissa McCarthy was the best thing in the movie. I thought she was hilarious.
She has great comic timing, yes.
Yeah. Well, she's a great example of somebody who she's horribly flawed as a character, has serious problems, and a complete idiot, but deep down her character's a good person.
Mm-hmm.
And Kristen Wiig's character, arguably not. and Maya Rudolph's character, not really. And everybody else, I just didn't like the characters. She's the only character that I thought was decent. So
interesting. Well, and I was going to say about the length, you know, it is a Judd Apatow film, and his film, or he's produced it, but his films tend to always run long. Yeah. So
you realize his next directing movie is going to be over 3 hours.
God, I hope not.
It's totally going to, because what, like, Knocked Up was 2 hours and 20 minutes, and, like, you know, Funny People was 40 hours long.
I just, no comedy should ever be more than 95 minutes. It just, you just don't have that much material, you know?
Yeah. Unless you just want to prove to everybody how awesome your wife and kids are.
Right. And to be fair, Leslie Mann is awesome, but, you know,
She
doesn't have to be in every one of his films or every one of films that he produces for his friends.
I used to love Leslie Mann until we got Judd Apatow showing how much we should love Leslie Mann.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know what is interesting? Speaking of Leslie Mann, using an example of a character, in her character Knocked Up, there's another critic who I know who was, after we saw Knocked Up, he made a comment. He's like, her character was such a mean person, just a not nice person. He couldn't actually get into the comedy of her scenes. And a reflection, I'm like, you know, he's kind of right. I was okay with that character because it was just kind of his throwaway.
Yeah.
But that's kind of how I felt with Kristen Wiig, because there's always in the movie, there's that point where they come to a head. And there's that point, and you know the point I'm talking about, where there's the big blow up.
Yes.
And I was just like, wow, screw her. She's an ass. And it just kept going. And I'm like, it went to the point of being inexcusable for me. So it's funny. I didn't realize how much I disliked the movie. And so
right.
I really started talking.
Or I didn't realize how judgmental you were of anyone over 30.
Anyone over 30, alcoholics in the front.
Right. So the message is get your together.
Get your shit together.
By the time you're 30. Oh, okay.
Get your shit together.
Well, if you hit 30, get your shit together, because Kevin Carr is not going to have any sympathy for you.
So I'm gonna say it sucked. What's your rating?
What are the ratings again?
Sucked or rocked? Kind of sucked or kind of rocked?
Kind of rocked. I'll still go with kind of rocked.
You'll go with kind of rocked.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah.
A little higher maybe, but
we're gonna go to the next. The next thing we got is we have a voicemail from Gabe from Arizona, who's supposedly named Steve. We're gonna start calling him Steve Gabe. From Arizona. So he has a real quick question here. We're going to play that real quick.
Hey, guys. It's Gabe from Arizona. What is your take on guilty pleasures? Do you believe in them? Personally, I'm on the fence. I do, but the more I think about the films I choose, I defend them to the point they're actually good movies, in my mind, lessening the guilty pleasure aspect. If you do believe they exist, then what are the films that you're guilty for loving? My number one, and probably to the end of my days, is Basic Instinct. Thanks, and talk to you soon.
So, guilty pleasures. Do you think guilty pleasures exist, Mel?
I do, actually. Mm-hmm. Indeed. I indulge in them frequently.
Let's start that way.
I'm sorry?
How would you define a guilty pleasure? In movies. I'm not talking about I'm not talking about a little rub and tug after, after a hard day at work.
And those shouldn't be guilty at all.
Who's guilty about that?
I think a guilty pleasure is actually defined by not being able to define it or defend it. You know, there are going to be films that you're just not going to be able to come up with cogent, rational reasons why it's a great film. But you go back to it time and time again. You have in your DVD collection, and you know it's sort of comfort food, and you just can't justify it. And I would say, you know, I won't say the vast majority, but a good number of horror films, science fiction films, that just by any means, you know, if you start asking what are the objective or the measurements or that we, you know, decide what a good movie is, and those films just don't meet it, but we still enjoy them on some level, maybe because they're campy, you know, they're over the top, maybe because they're inept in some ways.
What
maybe
are a couple
because,
good example of yours that you as a guilty pleasure?
Oh, well, one of my most recent guilty pleasures, and I'll just say it because I've watched it more times than I should admit by any account, and I can't justify it as a good film. And I'm sure you're going to laugh at this, Tron Legacy.
I love Tron Legacy. I wouldn't call it a guilty pleasure. I mean, I think it's flawed. I think it has issues with it, but I think there are some parts of it that are just astounding.
And it's all visually, yes.
Yeah.
But on a storytelling level, on a character level, you know, performances, you know, as much as I love Jeff Bridges, who doesn't love Jeff Bridges? Him basically channeling, you know, the dude. You're rewatching it, you know, the first time I saw it, I didn't even realize how many times he says man. And he says man in every scene. You're like, wait a second. Was he not? And you could just tell he really wasn't taking the movie seriously.
No.
You know, and he was sort of just ad-libbing and just.
See, I would defend Tron Legacy, and I've said this before, is because it every single problem Tron Legacy has the same thing as the problem with the first movie. So it's not like it was any better or worse than the first movie, but they were both awesome in their own right.
Well, yeah, it's weird that they would replicate some of the same problems, you know, and not recognize, well, the reason why the first one didn't succeed wasn't because it was so far ahead of its time. That might have been part of the reason, but the other reason is that it's just not a very good film on its own. Yeah. You know, the characters, the story is just kind of lumpy. It just sits there. The director, the directing is kind of flat. And a lot of that had to do with the technology at the time, that he had to have a static camera and couldn't move it around very much. But, you know, just the way the dialogue was delivered, it was very flat. You know, it's a movie about ideas and the visuals. And you're right, Tron Legacy has that too. But, you know, I can't justify why I've seen it 5 times since I bought it on DVD, on Blu-ray. You know, and it's become that film. Like, oh, I'm just going to pop it in. I'm going to pop it in when he goes into Tron World.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to watch the first 20 minutes because I've seen it already and there's not that much else going on there. So,
well, see, here's the thing. And like I said, I will defend Tron Legacy as a good movie. And I will defend, and Gabe mentioned this, Basic Instinct. I don't know if Basic Instinct would fall under my definition of guilty pleasure because it's a good movie. I think you can point to a lot of things where you're just like, this is a really well-done movie. Yeah, it's an exploitation film.
Yes.
For the 90s. Yes, it's extreme. Yeah, it's crazy. But still, for sort of that gritty detective kind of sultry erotic drama, it's fun. I mean, you couldn't, if you just like randomly wandered into the Basic Instinct on late night Cinemax, it would not look like all the other crap that's on Cinemax. It's a much better film. Whereas like Basic Instinct 2, great production value, absolute shit of a film.
Well, I don't know if I call it a guilty pleasure, but I know when I sat through Basic Instinct 2, I derived a lot of pleasure. I laughed.
Did you go through?
No. Well, it was just so over the top and all the sexual metaphors, and I don't think anyone was taking that movie seriously. I mean, if Sharon Stone was, you know.
Oh, she was totally taking it seriously. That's what made it so awful.
Yes. Well, I mean, just the direction and the dialogue, everything was just over the top, and I saw it in a room full of other critics, and there was just nonstop laughter. I rarely have heard as much laughter in a comedy as I did during Basic Instinct 2.
Oh. So, was there more laughter in that or Bridesmaids?
I would say at that. I would say at it was just, once the first critics sort of gave in and started laughing, and it was sort of just that moment where, like, it's okay to laugh. This isn't a comedy, but it's okay to laugh. Everyone just cut loose, you know? And it was hilarious. Not that I've seen it a second time since then, but
you're not gonna revisit that.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Here, my definition of a guilty pleasure is a movie. We're just talking movies, but it can be anything: book, you know, TV show, food. Food is a great. I'll use a food analogy too. But a guilty pleasure is something that deep down you know is not what you would consider quality. It may have elements of quality, but overall, it's not quality. And in general, there's an outside consensus that it's shit.
Yes, it's okay. Not a good film. Yes,
but you just love it anyways because it's fun. It's it reaches a primal element to you. I'll give a great example for me: The Happening. A lot of M. Night Shyamalan films.
Ooh, ouch.
Let's take out Airbender for right now, but Shyamalan movies, I know damn well that as they've gone along, they've gotten worse.
What happened to him?
And they're not good. Like, The Happening has some serious, serious problems to it. And it just is awful in certain respects, but I absolutely loved it. And a lot of people would throw, like, Michael Bay as an example of, take Transformers 2. The movie made $1 billion. Well, that's because it would have great action, but it has serious problems. And even if you loved Transformers 2, it's still, I think it has to be a guilty pleasure because there's no way to defend it as a quality film. It's fun.
Yeah.
It's got some great moments to it. And if you love Michael Bay, you're going to love it. But there's no way to defend that as a quality film. That, to me, is what a guilty pleasure is.
Yeah.
Whereas, like I said, like Basic Instinct, you can sit there and be like, well, it actually works as a detective story. And it's
a mystery, right, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, to that, that's, and to use a food analogy, a guilty pleasure is like McDonald's, a Big Mac. There's nothing good about a Big Mac. The meat is shit, the bun is shit, it's full of fat, it's full of carbohydrates, it's terrible for you, but and there's a general consensus from everybody else around there that it's not good, but it's fun to eat. That's how I consider it guilty. For me, guilty pleasures, like I said, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, Rennie Harlan movies. You taking an issue with the Harlan?
The Harlan. Bay, I can understand. But Roland Emmerich, I would say. I mean, Day After Tomorrow is just such, you know, cheesy, over-the-top political grandstanding. Right. And, you know, just everyone in, you know, the other element is that no one ever behaves badly. Everyone behaves so well in his films, you know.
Yeah.
Even 20, I think he sort of played a little bit around with that because of the criticism in 2012. But he just goes over the top, and it's just one big action scene, and how much destruction can you put on film? And, you know, I can't think it has any sort of culturally, socially redeeming value. Yeah. But when you're sitting through it, it can be a lot of fun. You know?
Absolutely. I'll give you another weird little example is if you watch like crap TV, like I know people who like watch The Bachelor. I hate The Bachelor.
Oh, yeah.
But I know people that'll watch it because it's just such garbage and it's so fun to watch for some people. And I think that's what it is if it's guilty pleasure. You have to have a certain level of guilt in liking it. I mean, you don't have to sit there and be writhing in guilt, but hey, it's fun and it's enjoyable. And you're like, shut up, I like it. That if you're going to be like, shut up, I like it. That means it's a guilty pleasure. So
the shut up, I like it is the,
yeah. So if you have to say, if you say shut up after the movie, after admitting you like the movie, yeah, and I think you can also be, I think there's also, let me do a little caveat. I think there's things that you could call guilty unpleasures, which are movies that you just, or shows that you can't stand, even though you really probably know you should.
Ah, okay.
You know, and I'll use a great example. Anything by Joss Whedon. I know as a geek, I'm supposed to like Joss Whedon, but I just can't get it.
I just feel like I got punched in the gut.
I don't like Joss
Whedon. I know I do. I knew.
You know
I do.
That.
But you also know that I love Joss Whedon.
I know.
And you know what? I had a standing bet with a friend of mine. I thought he was going to make it, and he did. And so this guy owes me dinner that he was going to get fired from this from the Avengers, and they started production, and Joss Whedon is still a director.
Wow.
Considering all the projects that he's been kicked off of or didn't work out for him.
No, I knew Avengers was, he was going to take that to film, and then he's not going to make another one afterwards because it's going to be a mess. It's not, I don't think the Avengers is going to, because it's just, Joss Whedon is not a mass audience guy. And it's going to be one of two things. It's going to be completely directed by the production company. Disney's just going to have all the executives direct it, which it might come out okay, maybe. Or he's going to do what he wants to do, and it's going to do the business of Serenity.
I think the built-in appeal of the characters. I mean, I think for whatever flaws of trying to shoehorn in all the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff and all the Avengers stuff and not actually tell straight stories about the characters that the movies are named after, like Thor, Iron Man 2, I think have had some, you know, serious problems story-wise there. But I'm hoping that Captain America won't have that problem because it's set in World War II, so it'll be more self-contained. But
if Bruce Banner and Nick Fury are going to have witty banter, Joss Whedon style, it's going to kill the film.
I don't think I think he's smarter than that. He didn't really do that with Serenity, Firefly, because of the setting.
Totally.
Well, he had witty banter, but he couldn't do the pop culture stuff because it's a different culture. And I'm hoping that he understands
the Chinese thing. And I think Firefly and Serenity are as Joss Whedon as you get. Don't you?
I thought he showed some restraint there, and I would imagine that since he didn't write the original script, there's a recognition that he's working on a major franchise, maybe for his career, etc. But that he's not going to Whedonize the script too much.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I think where his strengths are in character interactions and character building. So I he's going to have a fairly good cast. I mean, whatever you think about Ed Norton not being Banner, the Hulk, Mark Ruffalo
I think Ruffalo's going to be fine.
Yeah, I think Mark Ruffalo is great, and I don't think you can go wrong with Robert Downey Jr. right now. So I think Robert Downey Jr.
I'm sure that people 15 years ago were saying the exact same thing, and probably were they wrong.
No, but Robert Downey Jr. I think it may not last more than 3-4 more years before audiences tire of him. But right now he's the A-list actor, and people love him as Tony Stark.
Yeah.
And they will go see the Avengers opening weekend. So I think $100 million is pretty much guaranteed for the Avengers. But past that, whether it will hit $200 million, which is what they're obviously hoping for, or more, who knows? But a lot of that also depends on the story, the villains, you know, the action scenes. And I think one of the reasons they selected Whedon is because of his TV experience and bringing Serenity in at a fairly low budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Marvel being Marvel, they do like to cut corners in the way they've paid some of their talent. So I don't think he's getting paid that much, but I think they like the idea that he's going to bring more value on screen.
And this is not me being against Whedon. This is me saying I think Whedon has his he definitely has his audience, and he definitely plays to that. But his audience has never been a large audience. It's been a rabid, faithful audience.
Well, you've got a very good point there. Yeah. And whether he'll be able to modify that enough so that people like you who aren't fans will have a problem with it. And he'll attract a mainstream audience. I'm willing to give him a shot.
Oh yeah, I'll go see it. But yeah, like I said, if
I mean, whoever thought 5-10 years ago, an Avengers movie. I never imagined it happening.
Well, yeah, but there's reasons for that. I do think, it has yet. I am skeptical. And I have hope because I'd like to see more of these superhero people. This is the other reason why I think, and this is why I think the deck is stacked against. What did I say? The deck is stacked against Whedon on this one in particular is because, look, movie fans and superhero fans, especially critics and bloggers, are so freaking fickle, especially when it comes to these movies. Because I remember when the first Iron Man came out and they had that little tag, the Nick Fury thing, and everyone was like, oh, awesome, they're going to be able to bring this together. And I remember, like, even a couple years before they did Iron Man, like 5 years before, when they were doing the Incredible Hulk, or the first Hulk movie, and Daredevil, and there were some stories written because Marvel at that time was not owned. Now it's owned by Disney. And,
yes.
But they're still resolving studio issues, whereas DC can do as many crossovers as they want. Ironically, they're not, because that's all under the Warner Brothers umbrella. But back, 8 years ago, you had Fantastic Four being done by Fox. You had Spider-Man being done by Sony. You had Hulk being done by Universal.
X-Men done by 20.
It was like 3-4 studios. And then you had the Punishers being done by, at the time, Artisan, which became Lionsgate.
Yeah.
So it's all over the map. And people are like, oh, you can't resolve them. And finally, when Marvel Studios came about and started doing Iron Man, they're like, oh, this is awesome. We can bring these together. And then in Iron Man 2... when they actually are making an attempt to put the story in there that you need, and just like, oh, it's shoehorned in. Everyone's like, oh, bitching about it. I'm like, well, wait a minute, people. What do you want? Do you want to try and tie these together over like 3 or 4 movies? You're going to have some awkward pacing and stuff like that just to get the story told for the people who don't know what's going on. Or do you want it to be all separate? And so it's actually coming to light where people are complaining because
I was among them. I just felt it wasn't well integrated into the story. That maybe it was just the writers they hired, and they hired armies of them, 10, 12 of them, just really didn't find a way of integrating, the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff, the Avengers stuff, building on that, in a more organic way.
How are you going to tell a movie that's an effective sequel? We're talking Iron Man 2, an effective sequel that brings back all these main characters, that deals with Tony Stark and his arc, plus add Nick Fury and all this S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff and make it cohesive and do it on a very limited budget, limited time to meet a release date that is within a window of interest from the first movie. I mean, that's a monumental thing. And I'm sure somebody's out there going, well, Nolan could have done it. And like, fuck Nolan.
but Nolan's doing his own self-contained universe. You know, and he's got a huge benefit there that he, because of the success of the first two movies, he's got pretty much complete control over the third film.
Same thing would happen if suddenly they're like, you know what, you need to somehow tie this Dark Knight Rising into the Man of Steel. You'd have the same problems Nolan would face because you're trying to do a lot in a movie.
You end up doing too much. I think you end up and Thor had that problem, but I actually think it worked a little bit better because you had the S.H.I.E.L.D. stuff integrated into investigating Thor and the hammer and all that. So it didn't feel like we're just pushing this into the story, you know. And I mean, Agent Coulson.
That's what I'm saying with
Well, Iron Man,
why the deck stacked against him, because how many heroes does he have to tell a story to? He's like, what, six characters in this, and he's got to, you know, give everybody play and absolutely make it all cohesive. I think this is the one of all the Marvel movies. This is the one you don't want to have to direct.
It's a huge challenge. And the whole idea of the shared universe is like, oh, all these characters could cross over into each other, but then it ends up constraining what he can do because whatever happened in Iron Man, Iron Man 2, and Thor and Captain America, that constrains the choices that he can make.
Yeah.
You know, he has to refer to that. He can't deviate from what those films have already done. Yeah. You know, so yeah, it's a massive, massive challenge. Like I said, I thought Thor handled it a little bit better than Iron Man 2. My main problem with Iron Man 2 was you had the villain basically off camera for two-thirds of the film. It's like, if you have a problem with a passive protagonist, you have a passive antagonist who's sitting around doing nothing except tinkering with robots. You know, he should be out in the field as an aggressive, you know, he should be coming after Tony Stark. Yeah. You know, you had the best action scene on the racetrack at the beginning, in the first 20 minutes. It's like, wow, you know, you needed to flip that.
We need more of Mickey Rourke's sausage fingers in that.
Yeah. Yes. But I think that was the constraint there that Jon Favreau, I think, mentioned earlier, before we started the podcast, that Jon Favreau was constrained because of the release date, and the script maybe wasn't quite ready, and he just had to push forward with what they had. And I think, you know, it was.
But they would have they would have lost so much momentum if Iron Man 2 was coming out this year.
Absolutely, absolutely. No, you're right. I think one of the things that they're doing now, which I think they hadn't done before, because, you know, they hired the writer for Iron Man 2, Justin Theroux, after it was clear that Iron Man was already a success.
Yeah.
So they were already behind. And you already hear talk about the writers for Thor and for Captain America working on sequels.
Yeah.
They're working on those scripts now, regardless of whether they make them or not. It's probably a very small investment on Marvel's part and Disney's part.
Oh, it's like the cappuccino budget on the actual set. It's like $20,000 to get a writer to write a original script for
that.
Especially if it's a bigger name. If he's got some credits behind him, he maybe get 25. But it's less than $1 million, which is a drop in the bucket for a $150 million movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And if they could have better product and better integrated instead of rushing through.
Yeah. Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
Anyways, I don't know how the hell we got on the topic of that, but off of guilty pleasures, let's move on and talk box office. Last week, Thor did not beat the numbers that Fast Five got, but it played exactly to expectations, maybe just a hair above, or at the high end of the expectation, $66 million.
Pretty impressive. Yeah. I mean, people obviously, or Marvel was hoping for Iron Man, but I don't think Chris Hemsworth, not, you know, being an unknown commodity.
There was no way. There's the only recognizable name in that movie was
Natalie Portman.
And the only reason that she was recognizable is she just won the Oscar a couple months ago.
The ubiquitous.
Even then, people are like, I mean, people like you and I know who she is. But anyways, I thought that was good, especially for a character like Thor, which is that's a challenge to explain who that is to the.
I thought he was going to be the, you know, when I heard about a standalone Thor movie, that's the one I thought was going to be the potential stumbling block, that if it didn't do well, they would. But it, everything's already set in motion. I mean, it has to be, if you want to have these movies come out, you know, on a yearly basis.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to take the risk of, well, if Thor doesn't succeed, well, you still have the Thor character. I mean, you know, when they remade. Or rebooted, Incredible Hulk.
Yeah,
it did very similar numbers to the first one,
almost exactly the same.
Right, and you know, it's like, well,
that was a far, far better movie, but
the numbers were the same, so we're probably not going to see a Hulk sequel, and I think that's fine. I don't know if the character really merits more standalone movies. I mean, you know, he had a TV show. That was great.
Hulk is a challenge for a standalone movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also Fast Five did okay, but it had a huge drop.
Bigger than I expected. I think the last one also had a huge drop, but this one seemed precipitous. I mean, for it to do so well, you'd think there would be at least, you know, enough of a return audience. You know,
I don't think it's a see twice kind of movie.
No.
And it lost all of its IMAX screens. But yeah, it went from like 86 million to like 33.
Yeah.
I mean, it was low. I mean, it was like 60%, which I was totally expecting because I used the whole Twilight, you know, rate of attrition. It's going to top out domestically. You know, I'll be surprised if it cracks 200 million.
Yeah. At this point, I would, you know, after that first week, I'm like, oh, 200 million seems like a given. But when you've only made what, 120, 110,
one 140, I think now. So,
but it's,
I mean, this weekend, it's not going to, I mean, the only thing that's going to save it is I really don't think there's a whole lot of people going to be going to see Priest, but,
And there's no other major blockbuster of that nature that's coming out. I mean, you have smaller films and Bridesmaids.
Well, next week is Pirates, and that's going to knock it completely off the map.
Yes. When does Pirates come out? I thought it came out the week after.
Next week.
Does it
20th?
Really?
The 20th, yeah. What do you think is going to win this weekend? I think Bridesmaids, even though I didn't like it.
As far as new releases, you mean?
Yeah. Or anything. What do you think is going to top the... Do you think Thor is going to beat Bridesmaids?
I would say yes.
Really?
Yes. I'm not usually big on box office numbers because I tend to be wrong. But I see Thor still pulling ahead, maybe making half of what it just made.
I think it'll still have
a 50% drop. But I don't see Bridesmaid, it's an R-rated comedy, female cast. I don't see it making more than 25-30 mil. I think it's probably gonna be closer to 20 mil actually.
I think Bridesmaid's gonna do a lot better than that because of the female audience. Mm. The female audience is insane for this movie, and I hope you're right. I mean, I didn't like the movie, but I definitely would want to be the people releasing it because I think it's going to do well.
They screened the hell out of it. I mean, yeah. I saw it a month ago. You know, I mean,
yeah.
And they had like 5-6 screenings. You know, too often we just get one screening. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's the week of. It's and that's it. You either make it or you don't. Yeah. This one had like 5 choices going back to beginning of April. I'm like, wow, awesome.
Yeah, we had a whole bunch, and the thing is, the last couple weeks, you know, the movies that like Something Borrowed, which should have been brought out the female audience, tanked because I don't think anyone was interested in that movie.
Yeah,
because I don't think anybody can relate to that, and it's a hard sell to a female audience. A story about a woman cheating on her best with her best.
Yes, I was going to say the infidelity angle is a real hard sell, and
women don't like that, but. Women who feel like they're in their 30s and aren't going anywhere and have catty issues with other women, oh, they can totally relate to that.
Oh, to Bridesmaids.
Bridesmaids, yeah. No, I think Bridesmaids is going to do huge.
Yeah, well, you know, they're being...
I wouldn't be surprised if... I wouldn't be... It might be neck and neck with Thor, but I wouldn't be surprised if it beats Thor, you know, even a little bit. That's my thought.
Well, I'm curious to see how it does. And I think you're right about Fast Five.
Oh, I mean, it'll be 15 to 16
million. Yeah, yeah. Moment. I mean, it's just, it's dropping like a stone. So.
Well, and there's so much other stuff because you got Thor that's still taken away from it. I think Priest, to a certain degree, is going to take away from it. And then next week with Pirates, it's just going to... And Pirates is it next week.
Yeah, it's got the whole weekend.
Gonna just kill everything.
Yeah, and but I don't think Priest is going to make more than 15, 20 mil. I mean,
no,
it's very typical of Screen Gems films and genre films of that kind to not top out above 25 mil, and I think 25 would be
huge
for them to make that much money.
No,
even with 3D screens, and they're pushing that 3D angle, and that's why they pushed it back from last year.
Against it. I think it's going to work. Too many people are pissed off having to pay extra. They'll be like, yeah, I don't need to see that.
Yeah, and once you hear it's post-conversion 3D too, it's like enough of that, you know?
I don't think the general audience makes a difference between those two. I mean, you and I in the blogosphere and the geeks, they know the difference, but most people just see 3D as 3D.
Well, and now they're seeing lots of shitty 3D crappy 3D.
Well, but I mean, I think it's more just the money. People have seen the 3D, so it's the novelty's worn off, and I'm not saying people don't want to see it.
Absolutely.
But I've said this multiple times on the show that you take a movie that people might want to see, and you throw an extra $4 or $5 on the ticket price, and it's going to be a rental.
Right.
Or a wait until it comes to the dollar. I've had people say that. I was talking to somebody not too long ago, and they were talking. I think it was about Tron, and they said they didn't. And Tron was a great 3D experience, but they said that they went and saw it for $3 at the Dollar Theater, and it was much better.
Wow. So. Well, I have to say one thing about Tron because of the way, even though they use 3D cameras, 3D process, all that. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was a good, maybe not great, 3D experience. Mm-hmm. Partly because the interior Tron world is so completely dark. So that often you don't get the same sort of depth that you would get from other films.
Did you see it on IMAX? Because I really noticed it. I thought it looked great in IMAX.
Oh, no. They didn't show it to us in IMAX, but it was in 3D. But when I've seen it here, you know, at home, mm-hmm. Blu-ray, I love it. And just the level of detail that I didn't catch on a giant screen. And I think also the problem that you have with the Jeff Bridges as Clue, the de-aged Bridges, which is so incredibly distracting. When it's a giant, 70-foot head on a screen, yeah. When you're watching it on TV, it's not as bad. There are a few scenes, a few shots that look really weird.
You don't notice the uncanny valley as much.
Yes. Yeah, some of the lighting around the eyes looks kind of weird, the way his eyes move. And he just looks like he has a frozen face, you know? It's like, why can't he, you know, lift his lips when he's talking or move his lips, you know?
No, makes sense.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to the Fat Guy 5. Which is in an honor. We could do something with weddings, but Jeremy Kirk and I did one with weddings last week. This is 5 kick-ass religious figures in film in honor of Priest, who somehow priests become ninjas and throw stars and kill vampires. That's pretty kick-ass.
Indeed.
The first one is one we just recently saw this, because for those who follow us on Twitter, Mel, who's Fyodorfish. Yeah, we didn't let people know who that was. He's Fyodorfish on Twitter, and we do live tweeting of movies every Saturday night, 11 o'clock. Bunch of people all across the Fruited Plain watch a movie and make fun of it.
And it's often a lot of fun. Always a lot of fun. I think it's better when we pick the bad movies, Mystery Science Theater 3000 style. When we pick actually good films.
We're doing Tremors this week, which will prove to be fantastic.
I think so.
We can't pick like esoteric serious movies like Runaway Train. Whose idea was that?
Mine.
Yes, it was yours.
It was mine. I hadn't revisited it in a long time, but I believe you hated it, right?
I hated it. Oh my
With
God.
A passion, yes.
Yes.
It's such a weird, quirky movie, but I still get a kick out of it. That might be a guilty pleasure right there.
There is, because there's nothing good about that.
Oh. John Voight overacting? Come on.
John Voight. And it was like you, Rebecca De Mornay and her hotness.
Covered in
pink. Completely covered in clothes.
Yeah, yes.
One more thing about Bridesmaids. Can we get some tits in a movie sometime, Jon Apatow? Because you never show it. And you have R-rated movies all the time, and you don't show any boobs.
I've wondered that, too. Has our society become so prudish that if it's an R-rated comedy, you can just have vulgarity in the language?
You can have somebody shit their pants, but you can't show some boobs.
Some gratuitous boobage.
Anyways, going back to the 5 kick-ass religious figures. First one is Father John Magruder, the Kung Fu priest from Dead Alive, a.k.a. Brain Dead.
Who deserved a film of his own.
He did.
My biggest disappointment with that film was that he did not. He's in it for such a short, brief time.
Yeah, and he wins the award for the name of I Kick Ass for the Lord, for the line, I Kick Ass for the Lord. And what's funny is he's a kung fu priest or a kung fu reverend, really. Is he a priest or a reverend?
Yeah, well, I think they're interchangeable. Yeah. They call themselves priests, even
Those
though they can
Kiwis.
Yes.
But then when he turns into a zombie, he just wants to screw.
All the things he couldn't do in life, you know?
Yeah.
He does in zombiehood or whatever it is. But the first time I saw that movie and that scene just came out of nowhere and the line and you're just, you know, I wanted more of that. I really wanted more of that. I mean, it's Dead Alive has more of that with other characters, but of him, you know, I think it would have been just a great spin-off character. But unfortunately, the way the fate of his character didn't allow that, so.
Yes. The next one in line is Muad'Dib from Dune, which is Paul Atreides, played by Kyle MacLachlan. He is a religious figure, and boy, does he kick ass.
Much ass. Although not personally, right? I mean, outside of killing Sting at the end.
He blows up Sting. He bursts his organs from the inside.
It's a great way to kill somebody.
With his own name.
Yes.
There's also Father Marin from The Exorcist. You know, what's more kick-assiness than kicking the ass of
the devil
himself? dying in the process. And yes, Father Karras did kind of bring the devil out and then kill. Well, maybe Father Karras deserves
it. Yeah, well, I think you could give it to both of them as one slot for the two of them.
Yeah, because he's a boxer.
That's right. That's right. He's a boxer. Well, he's a Jesuit, and the Jesuits tend to be more physical, and you know, they're
Yes,
I think there's that element in them that they're not afraid of worldly things like boxing and exercise and athletics. Mm. So I mean, Notre Dame, you know, has the history and school I almost went to, believe it or not.
And they don't, but they don't let boobs in either. They're just like Judd Apatow.
Yes.
The next one, I'm going to skip ahead to the next one, which is Father George Carlin's character from Dogma, and you know, who is going to introduce the Buddy Christ.
Yes, and he is probably the best character in Kevin Smith's best film ever.
Okay.
Well, considering my low opinion of Kevin Smith, and I thought you took some risks there, but yes.
We'll table that discussion for another time. But that's okay. No, I know a lot of people love Dogma. And then the last one I just got to put on their list, which you were surprised that they threw this on there because you didn't think of him as a religious figure, and that would be Darth Vader.
Yeah,
because he is an old wizard
of a from kind, a
long extinct Jedi, which isn't really that long. It's like 30 years extinct. So, and
Jedi turned Sith, and you know, it's been ages. There is a movie called Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter.
Yes, I've heard of that,
and I saw it, but years and years ago, back in college, on a cheap video, you know, VHS, yeah. And I didn't pay much attention to it. So,
that was your addition.
Yes.
Okay. So that's good. We'll use that as our honorable mention.
Okay.
The other honorable mention I was going to do was Gaius Baltar, but that's from Battlestar Galactica. Technically, that's television, so not in film. So, yes, Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter.
And now we're going to get Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
I know. Wait till we get... What are we going to get? We're going to get Benjamin Franklin Vampire Hunter. What would be really interesting if you had Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr as werewolf zombies. Hunters shooting bullets. And like always just constantly shooting at each other and accidentally hitting werewolves with silver bullets in the background. Anybody who has history buffs or fans of Michael Bay's commercials might get that joke. Anyways, I think that's it. Let's move out of this segment and go to the end.
Okay.
Welcome back to Fat Guys of the Movies. In the last segment, we talked about Bridesmaids, and we talked about Guilty Pleasures from a neat little voicemail we got. We talked about Box Office. We somehow talked about The Avengers and Joss Whedon. And what else did we talk? We talked about some crazy stuff.
Kick-ass Priest. Yes.
Priest, yes. Priest, the Fat Guy 5. Now we are going to be... What are we doing next?
It's the world-famous DVD Roundup.
You said that with such excitement. I have to give you credit. That was mostly the guests are like, whatever. Whatever. Like they're like a teenage kid who's like, whatever, dad. You're stupid. And you were like right there.
Oh, well, thanks.
You're like the kid who's always volunteers for all the prom committees and never goes to prom.
No,
I'm just teasing.
I did actually go to prom.
Did you go to prom? Did you have a date?
I had a date. She was the most beautiful girl in the junior class. Yes.
Wow. Really?
Yes. It took a while. Like, it took a lot of effort.
What's she like now? She's a single mom with like 8 kids on Long Island. Now.
She was not surprisingly. Maybe that's I'm being rude. She was beautiful and smart. She ended up going to an Ivy League.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was a great combo. But her parents hated me. Oh. So. That's what did in our relationship.
That's why she went out.
Yes.
So did you get some?
I'm not going to show you. It's prom night. Curious.
First base, second base, third base? What are we talking about?
Well, one of the reasons why her parents hated me, yes.
Was there a base involved?
There were multiple bases involved, yes.
Wow. You dog.
But I won't mention her name. But yes.
Well, that's good. We wouldn't want that to happen.
Just in case she somehow finds this, listens to this, and tracks me down and
you'll get on
does
Twitter,
horrible things to me.
Yeah, or she'll be like, hey, I got my Ivy League college and my 8 kids. I'm living on Long Island. Do you want to come?
Well, she wanted to be a doctor, so who knows? Maybe she did it.
Is it Natalie Portman?
It's not Natalie Portman.
What a great lead-in. We can talk about No Strings Attached, which is on DVD. This is an awful movie. Don't rent it. It's got Natalie Portman and Ashton Kutcher as just gorgeous people who only want to have sex with each other.
Well, actually, he wants to have more than sex.
Yeah.
Than her. He wants the full-on relationship, and she just can't stand that.
Yeah, what always bothered me about this movie, aside from the fact that it's just not funny, is that it's like, I'm Natalie Portman, I'm totally gorgeous, and I'm a successful doctor, and I just want to have sex, but I can't find anybody to do that for me. I'm like, really? Seriously? Do you live on planet Earth?
Well, yeah, there was this whole, I don't know, maybe they got lost in the various drafts or her backstory and why she's, you know, so emotionally repressed.
You're so forgiving on this movie. Like, well,
it's Natalie Portman, I guess. I don't know. Oh. And it had, what's her name? Greta Gerwig.
Greta Gerwig. Well, but she was bare. I mean,
she's barely there.
Greta Gerwig in that movie is like, you know, liking the costume designer on, you know, a South Park episode. It's just barely noticeable.
But when a movie's so subpar, you kind of, you know, there's some positive somewhere. You just kind of cling on to it for dear life, you know? I mean, she was the best thing in Arthur, and that was not a very good film.
She was adorable in Arthur, though, and you got some sense of her story.
Oh, yes, she was.
But that's not out on DVD today, this week.
It's never coming out.
Home Improvement, the entire series, in a Binford collectible toolbox set, apparently.
And did you watch every single episode?
I have seen every single episode of Home Improvement, yes.
Wow.
It's not a great, but it does grow on you. A lot of these comedy sitcoms do tend to grow on you. There's also The Illusionist and I Saw the Devil, which I haven't seen either, but not for lack of trying. It's just, I'm not going to go buy them.
Unfortunately. Well, I've seen bits and pieces of The Illusionist, and it's the director who did the Triplets of Belleville.
Yeah.
So it's mostly a silent, there's very little dialogue. It's mostly music and sound effects and hand-drawn animation, and it just looks stunning.
Is it very much like Triplets of Belleville, where it's just sort of these stories going to stories?
No, I think it's still one story, and it's actually based on a script that was unmade by a French filmmaker named Jacques Tati, whose films were very much in a similar vein, where there was very little dialogue. And the main character was sort of this, I won't say buffoonish, but he was sort of a comic older character trying to deal with the modern world and not really succeeding. So there were a lot of sort of comic gags and verbal humor from other characters based on his character's lack of awareness, should we say. And some of it is very clever, very, very elaborate. Mm-hmm. But it was a script that he never made or had a chance to make. Mm-hmm. And I recommend his work actually quite a bit.
Awesome.
Yes.
Also on Blu-ray is the Alien Blu-rays. The Alien movies Blu-rays are available individually. You could get the anthology last year, but now they're available individually. What do you got? We got about a minute.
I'm sorry.
What's your pick for the week?
Oh, it would have to be the Aliens. Well, Alien and Aliens and Blue Valentine, which I know you hated, but I loved. It was my favorite film of last year. You know?
Really?
Yes.
That's because you love Ryan Gosling.
And Michelle Williams, they were terrific. I thought the story just was raw, brutal, honest. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, it's not a film I want to see. It's not a guilty pleasure, but I thought it was terrific in the way it really dig deep into the many failings of romantic relationships. Wow.
She was naked in it. Anyways, that would have been my stinker. But we got to wrap up reviews. We had Priest with Preemptive Suck. Bridesmaids, you said kind of rocks. I said sucked. Everything Must Go, you said kind of rocks-ish. And I said sucked. And then Hesher was rocked, right, from you?
Kind of rocked. Oh, yeah, it's in between kind of rocked and rocked.
Okay.
And it's Joseph Gordon-Levitt, great performance by him again.
Cool. Next week, we've got Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides. And thank you to Mal Valentin for coming in. And, did I say Mal? I meant Mel. Valentin for coming in from eCritic.com, Fyodorfish on Twitter. Thanks again for doing the show.
My pleasure. Love it. Right. Thank you.
Great. We will talk to you guys next week.